Welcome to the first talk of 2021 in the regular speaker series sponsored by the Hoover Institution's Project on China's Global Sharp Power. I am Glenn Tiffert, manager of the project, and it's my pleasure today to introduce what for many will be a fresh perspective. Asia is home to some of the world's most magnificent civilizations and significant rising powers, none more so than India and China. And here in the United States, our appreciation of that is reflected in the strategic concept of the Indo-Pacific. As you might imagine, India and China have a long history of interaction with one another, exemplified perhaps by the spread of Buddhism from India into China beginning nearly 2,000 years ago. We are, in a sense, heirs to that. The etymology of the English word China may, in fact, ultimately lead back to Sanskrit. But lately, the relationship has been characterized by intensifying economic and geopolitical friction, especially along the Himalayan frontier and in the Southern Oceans. While we could have sought a distinguished American speaker to address that evolving relationship between these two Asian giants, we wanted to try something a little bit different today. And in that spirit, we've invited one of India's most eminent strategic thinkers to share his views on this topic. Brahma Chalani is professor of strategic studies at the Center for Policy Research, a New Delhi-based think tank. He is a specialist in international security and arms control issues and formerly served as a policy advisor to India's National Security Council. He is a prolific columnist and the author of 9 books, including Water, Asia's New Battleground, which won the Bernard Schwartz Award from the Asia Society in 2012. After Professor Chalani speaks, he will be joined in conversation by a pair of distinguished Hoover fellows. David Mulford was U.S. ambassador to India from 2004 to 2009 and played a central role in shepherding closer relations between our two countries. Among the other highlights in his career, he served as chairman and CEO of Credit Suisse International from 1992 to 2004 and assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury for International Affairs from 1984 to 1992. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at both the Hoover Institution and the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. He chairs this project on China's global sharp power. He's one of the world's leading authorities on the study of democracy and democratization, and is the author of many, many articles and books, including most recently, Ill Winds. After their conversation, we will have a moderated Q&A period from the audience. You may use the Q&A button at the bottom of your screens to enter questions into the queue. Thank you very much. Brahma, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Glenn. I will place the China-India equation in the larger context of the Indo-Pacific. I will then draw some lessons applicable across the Indo-Pacific. And finally, I will offer some projections on what we can expect in the coming years. I will try to do all this in about 20 minutes or so. The current China-India border conflict has raised the specter of another border war or additional localized clashes. More than 100,000 rival troops are presently locked in a military standoff in icy Himalayan conditions. The face-off began last May after India discovered to its shock that Chinese forces had stealthily occupied mountaintops and other key vantage points in its northernmost borderlands. We can get a better understanding of the current Himalayan tensions if we look at the larger Asian picture. Chinese President Xi Jinping has opened multiple fronts in his campaign to realize what he calls the Chinese dream, which is to make China great again, perhaps as the world's foremost power. The Himalayan frontier is just one of the fronts he has opened. The other fronts range from South and East China Seas to Hong Kong and Taiwan. From breaking Beijing's binding commitment to Hong Kong's autonomy and attempting to police the waters off the Japanese-controlled Senkaku Islands, to picking a nasty border fight with India and ramping up military pressure on Taiwan, President Xi has pushed the boundaries. His expansionism hasn't spared even one of the world's smallest countries, Bhutan. For Beijing, the COVID-19 pandemic, which has preoccupied the world for nearly a year, has seemed like an ideal opportunity to make quick progress on its expansionist agenda. Emboldening Beijing is also the fact that the international costs of its aggressive expansionism and increasing repression at home have been negligible, or at least manageable. For example, its creation of a Muslim gulag that houses more than 1 million detainees has essentially gone unpunished, even though it's the largest mass incarceration of people on religious grounds since the Nazi period. Nor has China paid any tangible international costs for redrawing the geopolitical map of the South China Sea. If anything, it is seeking to replicate its South China Sea model elsewhere. The New York Times recently ran a headline. The headline was, Beijing takes its South China Sea strategy to the Himalayas. That headline aptly sums up what is happening in the Himalayas. To be sure, Beijing's muscular push to create a Sino-centric order is now beginning to invite an international pushback. It's also triggering major geopolitical realignments and a fundamental strategic confrontation with the United States. Let's be clear on one thing. China's various territorial claims in Asia are based not on international law, but on alleged history. In international law, a territorial claim must be based on continuous and peaceful exercise of sovereignty over the territory concerned. There's absolutely no evidence that China ever had effective control over, for example, the South China Sea or the Senkaku Islands or the border areas in Indian Ladakh region that it seized last year. In fact, China is India's neighbor, not by geography, but by employing guns, by occupying the historical buffer Tibet. Today, China's claims to India's Himalayan borderlands are based on the alleged historical links to Tibet. China's two potential peer rivals, as you know, in Asia are Japan and India. There are important parallels between the way China is pursuing its territorial revisionism against India and Japan, with the apparent aim to harass, encumber, and weigh them down. The Chinese Communist Party has a long record of pushing expansive claims against neighboring countries on the basis of an imaginative principle. What is ours, and what is yours is negotiable. That principle is seeking to apply against India. Now, what lessons can be drawn from China's current border conflict with India? In my view, the first lesson is that China's aggressive actions bear no relation with the state of its bilateral ties with the country it targets. For example, the Chinese border aggression in Indian Ladakh occurred just 6 months after President Xi Jinping declared during an India visit that China-India relations have entered a phase of sound and friendly development. When he said that, I'm sure he was already planning the aggression in Indian Ladakh, because that aggression must have been planned months ahead. Similarly, despite improving China-Japan relations, Chinese incursions into the Senkaku territorial waters and airspace have increased. This should serve as a warning to all states that China's aggressive revisionism is unaffected by bilateral considerations, including diplomatic progress. A second lesson relates to booming bilateral trade. India is paying a big price for having wrongly assumed that economic interdependence and booming trade would avert overt conflict. By the time China launched its aggression in Indian Ladakh last year, its trade surplus with India had more than doubled in just 5 years. The fact is that expanding economic ties, far from making China less aggressive, only constrict the other side's strategic leeway. For example, Japan's dependence on the Chinese market induces Japanese restraint, even in the face of provocative Chinese actions or statements. A third lesson is that attempts to placate Beijing tend to backfire. After Modi became India's prime minister in 2014, he sought to befriend China. In fact, he bent over backward to befriend China. His conciliatory steps included delisting China as a country of concern. Modi met Xi Jinping 18 times in 5 years before the Ladakh aggression. All warning signs in the run-up to China's aggression were ignored. Or take the case of Japan. Since the 2018 Beijing visit of the then Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Tokyo has laid emphasis on improving ties with Beijing and has responded with remarkable restraint to the longest series of Chinese incursions into Japanese waters. One startling fact is that no Japanese defense minister has ever conducted an aerial survey of the Senkaku Islands so as not to provoke China. But such restraint has only invited greater Chinese incursions. A fourth lesson relates to the strategy of China. After its disastrous 1979 invasion of Vietnam, China has focused on winning without fighting. Winning without fighting has been its strategy. Deception, concealment, and surprise in peacetime have driven China's bulletless aggressions. Its bulletless aggressions have included seizing the Johnson Reef in 1988, the Mischief Reef in 1995, the Scarborough Shoal in 2012, and now key vantage points in Indian Ladakh. The Ladakh encroachments occurred when a distracted India was wrestling with the coronavirus outbreak by enforcing the world's strictest lockdown. The ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu's advice to plan for what is difficult while it's easy led China to strike when India was vulnerable. All of which suggests that a Chinese strike against the Senkaku Islands or against Taiwan could occur when the other side least expects it. A fifth lesson is that as long as China perceives strategic benefits as outweighing costs, it will persist with the strategy of aggressive expansionism. The challenge that India and other democratic powers in the Indo-Pacific face is to find ways to make Chinese expansionism costly for Beijing. China's strategy of incrementally altering the status quo without incurring significant costs must be frustrated. Otherwise, Beijing will continue to destabilize the Indo-Pacific further. India, for its part, faces the risk of getting locked in a no-war, no-peace situation with China. Now, let me look ahead and quickly make some projections. First, President Xi Jinping has sown the seeds of enduring conflict with India. Given the fact that China and India together represent more than a third of humanity, a sharpening rivalry between these two giants will carry global implications. That's obvious. And India, far from accepting the new facts on the ground created by China's aggression, has matched Chinese troop deployments along the entire Himalayan frontier. And it has also occupied some strategic heights overlooking Chinese positions. My second projection is that a major Indian military buildup has become inevitable. In recent months, there have been a spate of major Indian missile tests, including of a hypersonic cruise missile, a hybrid missile torpedo that fuses two capabilities into a single weapon against submarines and aircraft carriers, and also the test of an anti-radiation weapon designed to seek and destroy enemy air defense systems. Such tests foreshadow India's military modernization on a significant scale. This buildup will also include a major expansion of naval capacity so as to adopt a much stronger maritime posture in the Indo-Pacific. India illustrates the old saying that those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. India is repeating history. India today is relearning the lessons of the 1962 war. The 1962 war was initiated by Mao to quote unquote teach India a lesson. The current Indian Prime Minister Modi, as I explained earlier, bent over backward to befriend China, blinding him to China's preparations for aggression. Now Modi has been left with no choice but to strengthen India's strategic posture significantly. My third projection is that a US-India strategic alliance, which has long been China's security nightmare, is becoming more likely. It was in response to China's territorial encroachments that India 3 months ago finally concluded, after years of negotiations, the last of four foundational agreements that the US reaches with all its allies. India in recent months has also become more integrated in the Quad. The Quad is at the center of America's Indo-Pacific strategy. Unless Joe Biden allows the historic opportunity to forge a US-India security alliance slip away, the world's most powerful and most populous democracies are likely to establish a strong partnership to underpin a stable balance of power in the Indo-Pacific. This alliance will bear little relationship or little resemblance to America's patron-client framework of the Cold War era that had the US as the hub and its allies as the spokes. No such arrangement would work nowadays for the simple reason that a country as large as India, especially one that values its strategic autonomy, cannot become just another Japan to the US. The US and India will enter into a soft alliance shorn of treaty obligations. The newly declassified free and open Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States document. It's called the US Strategic Framework for the Indo-Pacific. It was declassified last week by the White House and released to the public earlier this week. And if you look at that declassified document, it gives India pride of place in American strategy, stating that a strong India in cooperation with like-minded countries, would act as a counterbalance to China. That policy paper also highlights that the US objective is to accelerate India's rise and capacity to serve as a net provider of security in the Indo-Pacific. My last projection relates to economic decoupling. India will pursue a managed and selective economic decoupling from China. China's trade balance with India now represents its third largest trade surplus after its surpluses with the United States and the European Union. Now that India recognizes the folly of relying on China for critical supplies, the economic relationship between the two countries is bound to fundamentally change. I will conclude now with one quick point. Xi Jinping, with his Himalayan misadventure, has provoked a powerful adversary, placing the Sino-Indian relationship on a knife edge. This has come at a time when China's international free ride has ended. The international environment is becoming less and less favorable to President Xi Jinping's pursuit of, quote unquote, the Chinese dream. His strategic overreach, far from advancing China's preeminence in Asia, has intensified the pushback by Indo-Pacific's major democratic powers. And these democratic powers have deepened their security cooperation. When history is written, the year 2020 will be marked as a watershed year when China, through its own actions, began turning international opinion against it. I'll stop here. Glenn, back to you.
Thank you very much for that wonderfully cogent presentation. We now begin the conversation portion of our program, and I want to encourage our audience to put any of their questions in the queue using the Q&A button at the bottom of their screens. Ambassador Mulford, now over to you.
Thank you very much, Glenn, and good morning. I'll make very brief remarks that I hope help provoke discussion later on. Rama's summary of lessons on Xi Jinping's Himalayan overreach are welcome and very, very timely. The projections that he presents are also, in my opinion, on the mark. To be clear on where I stand, and to provide discussion points for today, I believe that geopolitically, India is becoming America's most important global partner. We may not be there yet, but we are not far off after the efforts of the last 20 years. For years, India diplomacy has done less well than it should have done with its immediate neighbors. This is changing as India embraces a more defined role in the Indo-Pacific affairs region. India is many things with a multitude of future possibilities, but it has this one unique reality that sets it apart from everyone else, and that is its border, quote unquote, with China. How India addresses this challenge that China increasingly presents to India in the next few years may well set the course of world history. This challenge will not wait. America's Tibetan Policy and Support Act, signed into law with, I would note, bipartisan support, unusually these days, recently in December of 2020, clearly defines the likely testing course for India's future border security. India's failures to China's failures to honor its pledges on Tibet since its ruthless invasion more than half a century ago will have to be faced by the world, just as its policies on Taiwan, on Hong Kong, and in the China Sea have to be faced. Our guest's article recently in the Times of India provides a graphic history of India's border relations with China as derived from Tibet's invasion 50 years ago. Brahma also points out that the Dalai Lama's succession will be a profoundly important event. His presence and the Tibetan community's presence in India has been critical in keeping Tibet and its culture alive. Very little of importance in this critical region of the world will not be touched by this event when it comes. Let us hope that wisdom, forethought, and courageous resolve will service at this inevitable moment. I also want to touch on Nepal, where in April there will be a general election after years of now divided communist government. India should direct a major diplomatic effort to its economic relations with Nepal, given Nepal's role over many years in preserving access to India for Tibetan refugees. Also, I must mention Bhutan, a most remarkable country, which over some 30 years has evolved from an absolute monarchy to a democratic constitutional monarchy under the guidance of its previous and present kings. Bhutan, with its population of some 800,000, lies immediately below Tibet. It has not created formal relations with the United States and the leading countries of Europe in order not to provoke China to invade it. But Bhutan is a critically important part of the China-India border scenario. I am fearful that China may choose to treat Bhutan as if it were a military base in the China Sea. India has hardened its stance with China by addressing aspects of its economic relations. This is unlikely, in my opinion, to be sufficient as a deterrent to China's border aggression and long-term objectives of accessing India's rich resources of minerals and water in its northern states. Strengthening U.S.-India ties, educating our public about these threats, and recognizing more clearly the growing ties between China and Pakistan needs to be a foreign policy priority of the United States. So I'll leave it there and over to Larry, and then we'll have an active dialogue as soon as you are ready.
I wanted to thank David for those eloquent remarks, and most of all, our distinguished speaker, Brahma Chalani. Begin by thanking you both for the longstanding moral and geopolitical light you've shed on Tibet. I think we can't lose sight of the human rights element here in terms of how brutal and deeply authoritarian the Chinese Communist Party state continues to be and has been becoming once again ever more so with the historic crushing of Tibetan autonomy and then the crushing of the autonomy and the mass religious persecution in Xinjiang. Thank you, Brahma, for speaking about it in such forceful terms. And then now most recently of the crushing of Hong Kong's autonomy. So part of the public education that you're both appealing for seems to me to be, as Brahma, you have done in very lucid analytical fashion here, to put this in a historical perspective and to see what's happening now in the Himalayas, in Hong Kong, in the South China Sea as part of a historic pattern under Chinese communist rule that goes all the way back to its conquest of Tibet and before. And I think speaking about the comparisons between the South China Sea's militarization and violations of international law and what's happening now in the Himalayas are necessary and deeply instructive. I also think that we shouldn't shy away from more what some might see as more provocative or shocking or even perhaps excessive historical analogies. I think, and I won't speak for him, but one of America's leading China scholars and my dear colleague and friend who had a longstanding initial sympathy toward the opening of U.S.-China relations and was an important academic figure in encouraging it now thinks, and a growing number of U.S.-China specialists who've not had anything but, I'd say, cordial and appropriate relations with, their peers in China, they think that what we're witnessing now bears important similarities to the behavior of the Nazi regime in the 1930s. And this is not to say that we should equate Xi Jinping with Adolf Hitler. But it is to say that what's happening now in terms of China's aggression, political aggression, military aggression, violation of international commitments, and its extremely aggressive evolution of its image of its role in the world bears important similarities to the behavior of the German state under Adolf Hitler in the 1930s, and in particular to the conquest of Czechoslovakia and to the illusions that Neville Chamberlain brought to Munich and came back declaring, we now have peace in our time, because we've satiated Hitler's appetite and given him a piece of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland. We have to learn from history, Brahma, that's your major point, that you don't, I'm sorry to put it in this way, you one sounds like a cold warrior if you speak so bluntly, but I think I'm not a cold warrior. But I am deeply committed to international security and freedom. And so, there's no point in sugarcoating it. If you seek to accommodate or humor wish away aggression, what you're going to get is more supercharged and in their minds, legitimated aggression. So now, Brahma, I'd like to push you or invite you to expand on several points. I don't think you're going to, have the time on initial response to respond to all of these, but these are some of the concerns I've had that I hope you might, over the course of our remaining conversation, be able to speak at least to some of these. First of all, I'd be very keen to hear any thoughts you might have more specifically on the components of India's military modernization on which the United States and India might cooperate, and not just on advanced weapons sales, but on research. And as we look to an era now, Glenn has been writing about this in terms of his work on China's penetration of and pursuit of compromising our research enterprise in high technology. where might India, with its growing array of engineers and scientists in the United States, cooperate on artificial intelligence and other high technologies? Secondly, supply chains that you spoke of. We, I think, are now waking up to the shocking levels of US dependence on critical inputs for our high technology sector and so on. And of course, here, Taiwan's importance in the semiconductor field grows, but how could the US and India cooperate to reduce the dependence of all democracies on critical technological and other supplies from the People's Republic of China that the PRC might use as leverage in a conflict? A third, the regional component that David spoke of in terms of South Asia more broadly. I know you're one of India's leading strategic thinkers, so perhaps over the course of our remaining conversation, you might say a few words about the South Asian picture. South Asia has been a region that has had, you know, a periods of significant prevalence of democracies. And then we've seen a growing instability of this. Sri Lanka, I would argue, plunged into a period of authoritarian regression under the Rajapaksa clan. And now the Rajapaksa clan is back in power, and the same family that ushered the way into debt bondage for Sri Lanka to China and giving away the support of the port of Hambantota to China's strategic ambitions, they're back in power now. One final thought, Brahma, it's a sensitive one. I apologize for raising it. I do so in all humility with keen awareness of how we look to the world now, we, the United States, in the midst of what we're going through. But you've both spoken about democracy being an important element of the bonds that India and the United States have historically shared, and of the ties with Bhutan, with Nepal, I hope again with Sri Lanka, that might bind South Asia and other actors in Asia beyond the, I'd say, emerging alliance of a sort between the US, India, Japan, and Australia. As there are concerns about what's been happening to democracy in the United States, there are concerns about the trends in terms of democracy in India. And maybe you had some advice for us on how people in the United States who want to build a closer strategic partnership between India and the United States should raise that issue.
Brahma, please respond if you'd like. We welcome your comments.
Larry has raised some fundamental issues, and I'll be very telegraphic in my response at this point. You know, I'm sure we can get back to these issues later in the Q&A. On the issue of US-India defense cooperation, I think he's right to point out that we need to go beyond defense transactions, that is, arms sales by the United States to India. There should be emphasis on joint projects, joint research and development projects that could serve as symbols of the growing strategic collaboration. And India's scientific manpower could be utilized to create projects that stand as examples of how two distant democratic powers can work together to build joint security. I think on the China-centered global supply chains, the US and India, as well as the Quad members, have been discussing this issue. They have been talking about resilient supply chains. That's become the phrase for diversification, or that is, or for, you know, for ending the reliance on dependence on China. I think we need to begin with the medical sector first, because the dependence on China is quite deep in several sectors. And in the discussions, it has been decided that in the first stage, the dependence on China for essential medicines and medical equipment, that needs to be taken care of. And I think if you look at the Indian response, India is the world's largest exporter of generic drugs, but 70% of the raw materials for the generic drugs come from China. And to end that dependence on China, the Indian government has embarked on a major program. It's offering incentives and subsidies to Indian manufacturers to manufacture those raw materials back home. And this is clearly a response to the developments of last year, when the world has realized that depending on China is risky business. On Larry's point about Indian democracy and the American democracy, I think the Indian democracy mirrors the American democracy in terms of hardened polarization. The gulf between liberals and conservatives in India is as wide, if not wider, than in the US. We face similar challenges as the United States in terms of how we can bridge those divides. The internal divides in India are becoming an important source of concern. In fact, they threaten to hobble India's great power ambitions. It's very important for India to have an open debate as to how it can begin a process to heal the polarization in society. Let me stop here, Glenn, and so that we can take this discussion forward.
Absolutely. We have a lot of excellent questions in the Q&A, and I invite more people to add to them. I think what I'm going to do is group some of the questions. So if I paraphrase you, I apologize. Let's start with some geostrategic considerations. We've spoken about the South China Sea. We've spoken about the Indian Ocean, but we haven't spoken about Central Asia yet. And there is a very old great game afoot, anew, in Central Asia, involving traditional regional powers, traditional in the sense of Russia, China, and again, India, at a time when the United States is drawing down some of its commitments, say in Afghanistan. And so we haven't spoken yet about Pakistan, we haven't spoken about Afghanistan, and we have not spoken about Russia's role in the region. And so I wonder if you could address all of those multifaceted conflicts and permutations of relations in the region and as they relate to the India-China relationship?
Well, I think Central Asia and Russia are certainly two very important issues. Central Asia, because it's become the center of a new great game, and that new great game largely involves two powers, China and Russia. And we have also seen in Kyrgyzstan, which is the only democracy in Central Asia, what happens when a mob storms the seat of democracy, the Congress, the parliament. Last October, a crowd stormed and occupied the parliament in Kyrgyzstan. And that has led to a chaotic turn of events. And finally, recently, last Sunday, an election in which the turnout was just 39%, the election produced a winner who was once convicted and jailed for kidnapping a provincial governor. So what we are seeing is a lot of flux in Central Asia. But I think the larger question is about Russia's role and the future of the U.S.-Russia relationship. If you look, if we go back and look at the second half of the Cold War, America's co-option of China in the second half of the Cold War played an important role in the ultimate triumph of the West over the Soviet Union. So it became a 2-versus-1 competition. Today, unfortunately, because of American policy, Russia has pivoted toward China. So it's become a 2-versus-1 competition, but in the opposite direction, with China and Russia joining hands against the United States. I think American policy needs to look ahead and think of ways it can actually break that growing relationship between two natural strategic competitors. These are not, you know, natural allies. These are natural strategic competitors, Russia and China. And American policy should do everything to break that growing bond between Moscow and Beijing. On the issue of Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Trump administration's rush in recent months to pull out all American troops, and also the Trump administration's deal with the Taliban 11 months ago in February last year, has spawned greater violence in Afghanistan. And that could destabilize the region. I don't know what the new administration led by Joe Biden is going to do in relation to Afghanistan. But I think cutting a deal with Karis certainly is not going to be conducive to advancing regional security or even advancing America's own long-term interests. So I hope there'll be a rethink on Afghanistan, Pakistan in the Biden administration. But I think the Biden administration's approach toward China is also a bit uncertain. It's unclear whether the Biden administration will continue with the policy approach of the Trump administration, which was to treat China as an implacable foe, as a strategic competitor, as an ideological, even existential threat to the United States. Will the Biden administration continue with that policy or treat China as a major competitor, but not as an implacable foe? That'll have major implications across the Indo-Pacific and across the entire world, because in recent months, even distant powers in Europe have come out with their own Indo-Pacific strategies, France, Britain, and Germany. If there's going to be a important shift in America's Indo-Pacific strategy under President Biden, this will even affect the direction of U.S.-India strategic collaboration.
Thank you. With the new administration in Washington, there's been increasing optimism that the United States may embrace a multilateral approach to international relations along the lines of some of what's been discussed here today, and in particular, re-engage multilaterally on economic relations, perhaps reviving some form of the ill-fated TPP. I wonder if you could address India's decision not to participate in the RCEP negotiations, to withdraw at the last minute, and what you think the possibilities for multilateral economic cooperation with the United States and other democratic Asian partners in the region might be.
We've had some developments since the U.S. presidential election that have not been conducive to building a democratic coalition against China. First was the RCEP signature by 15 countries, including 2 members of the Quad. And then more recently came the European Union's investment deal with China. Now, both are part of multilateral economic cooperation, but both send the wrong message. They send the wrong message in terms of developing a coordinated approach to dealing with China. India withdrew from RCEP because of China. If you know, if India had joined RCEP, this would have been a backdoor free trade agreement between India and China. India already has FTAs with most other RCEP members. The only important RCEP member with which India does not have an FTA is China. So if India had entered RCEP, it would have meant a backdoor FTA with Beijing. That would have opened the Indian market even further to the dumping of Chinese goods. So India pulled out entirely because of China. But to India's disappointment, Japan and Australia, which are Quad members, signed on to RCEP, and there has been even greater disappointment with the European Union's decision to go ahead with an investment pact with China.
Thank you. I wonder if we could turn to natural resources for a moment, in which you have a particular expertise. Obviously, the competition for water resources is part of the larger great game in the region, but it's also impacting ASEAN members in the Mekong Delta, who have found the regional flow of water greatly reduced by the building of Chinese dams. What role do you think India can play in providing a backstop to Chinese activity in the ASEAN region and in Southeast Asia, and in strengthening their ability to defend their own sovereignty and interests?
I think we should also get Ambassador Mulford and Professor Diamond into the discussion. I know they have expertise in all these issues, and in fact, the U.S.-India strategic collaboration began when Ambassador Mulford was serving in New Delhi. He played an important role in developing that relationship. But I think the issue of water is very important. And as Ambassador Mulford and Larry both pointed out in their remarks, that Tibet is the source of Asia's great rivers. The Mekong, which is the lifeline of continental Southeast Asia, originates on the Tibetan Plateau. So do the rivers of South Asia and the rivers of mainland China. They all originate on the Tibetan Plateau. Now, China has built 11 mega dams on the Mekong just before this river flows into Southeast Asia. And in December, last week of December, China has cut water flow in the Mekong by nearly 50%. 47% to be exact, for reasons that have to do with hydropower generation. They did not provide any warning to the downstream countries in Southeast Asia. Only when the downstream effects became glaringly apparent did China admit earlier this month that it is holding back water flow in the Mekong. And the Mekong's upstream dam projects are wreaking havoc downstream. And more recently, China has unveiled a mega project on the Brahmaputra, which is the major river of Northeast India and Bangladesh. Now that mega project on the Brahmaputra is going to be even bigger than the Three Gorges Dam, according to Chinese state media. That would mean environmental devastation, especially in Bangladesh, which is located furthest downstream on the Brahmaputra. And I think we need to raise the water issue we need to elevate the water issue as a strategic issue and focus attention on China's unilateralism. Unilateralism because the focus has been on China's actions in the maritime domain or on its land border with India. There has been very little international attention on what China is doing on the rivers that originate on the Tibetan Plateau. It's re-engineering the transboundary flows of the major rivers that are the lifelines of the peoples of South and Southeast Asia.
Thank you. Larry, I believe you had...
I just wanted to say that I was in Vietnam almost exactly a year ago. I was on the Mekong in part. And I will just say, Brahma, that what you're saying is just shockingly evident in what's happened to water levels on the Mekong. And it's not just the destruction of their economic life, as you were alluding to, it's the destruction of a whole way of life. And, you know, we've talked properly, I think, about the need to rally, you know, some kind of grouping or incipient alliance of democracies in the region. But I do think that clearly non-democratic regimes like Vietnam can also be engaged in some sort of, let's say, you know, points of concern on practical issues, and maybe, you know, quiet forms of even military cooperation that are going on with the United States now. And I'll just enlarge this point. Someone asked in the chat, you know, how can we make China feel consequences? And so I'll float this idea. I think there are a number of possibly people inside leadership ranks of the Chinese Communist Party, but certainly on the intellectual periphery of the Chinese Communist Party state, who are becoming alarmed at the growing isolation of the PRC and the reaction against it by people who are feeling these effects. And that is, I think, a point of leverage that we can really mobilize to bring about change.
Oh, David, did you? I'm sorry, David, please.
Well, I just wanted to underline a couple of points with regard to your last question. I think it's critically important today that the democratic countries convene together and decide and agree on what the true status of China is. Is it a competitor? Or is it an opponent, a very threatening opponent? My answer would be the latter, but I think there needs to be consensus on that, especially between the United States and India at this point. And then from there to develop policies which have the effect of more forcefully isolating China to increase their feelings of insecurity. Because if the entire world is against them, they're going to behave differently than if they just think it's a question of playing off one country against another. So I wanted to put that in. I think it's time for a major decision on this. And I would hark back to the fundamental decision made by the United States in 2005 under George W. Bush to engage in a civil nuclear negotiation with India, even though India had not signed the 1974 Non-Proliferation Treaty, and even though it was going to result in India keeping its nuclear weapons intact. And this really changed the direction and feel of US-India relations and produced a new depth of thinking about our overall geopolitical relationship, which is still unfolding. So I won't go into more detail on that, but it was remarkable in the end that all nuclear supplier nations, including China, finally agreed to give that exception to India that was then recorded in US law by name. So a very important step. And I think we need something like that now to sort of isolate China and really get a reality check on what they're really doing.
Thank you, Ambassador Mulford. We have just a couple minutes left, actually. And so, Brahma, I'd like to give you the opportunity to have a final word.
I think that Asia is at the crossroads. China is at the crossroads. India is at the crossroads. And I think even the United States is at the crossroads today. And the coming years are going to be critical in determining international security. I think important decisions are going to be made in this year, in 2021. And among the most important decisions will be the Biden administration's approach to the Indo-Pacific region. The Trump administration fashioned a free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, which has been embraced by India, Japan, Australia, and even European powers. But Joe Biden has never used the phrase free and open Indo-Pacific. In fact, he has coined a new term, a new phrase, secure and prosperous Indo-Pacific. A secure and prosperous Indo-Pacific means that even autocracies can be part of that order. And that would be a fundamental shift from the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, which was a democratic alliance that's sought to underpin a rules-based order. So I think the decisions that the Biden administration takes on the Indo-Pacific, on China, will determine the future direction of the growing strategic collaboration between the US and India. If I could put it bluntly, a softer US approach toward China will not facilitate the clinching of a soft alliance between India and the United States.
Thank you very much. That was Professor Brahma Chalani. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Ambassador Mulford, for a fascinating discussion. I want to bring to your attention the next event in our speaker series. We will be co-sponsoring a discussion on the Belt and Road Initiative with the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at FSI at Stanford, and that comes on January 28th. So check your calendars and Hoover announcements for that. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you, gentlemen. And that concludes this session.